The views expressed on the following broadcasts do not necessarily reflect those of KHLT, Take 12 Radio, or our affiliates. The opinions on this show should not be considered as medical, psychological, or professional advice and are those of the host, co-host, and guest. Take 12 Radio and KHLT Recovery Broadcasting are not affiliated with any particular 12-step fellowship.
One day at a time with its failures and fears. Portion of pain and burden of care, we must meet.
Welcome to Walking Through the Language of the Heart, a journey into the grapevine writings of Alcoholics Anonymous co-founder Bill W. And now, here are your co-hosts, Chris S. and the Monty Man.
Well, welcome, family, to another episode. This is all about walking through the book, The Language of the Heart, which features all of AA co-founder Bill W.'s writings in the grapevine from 1944 to 1970. This book includes how Bill came to organize AA's 12 steps, his first thoughts about the program's 12 traditions, emotional, spiritual growth, and much more. And on the phone with us once again is our co-host and good friend, Mr. Chris S. Hey, Chris.
What's up, Monty? How was your week?
It has been an active week, an interesting week. Hey, but unfortunately, and I think most people know, but maybe some don't, we lost William Borchert last Saturday, the screenwriter to My Name is Bill W.
Yeah.
and a screenwriter to movies like Serpico and the Bay City Bombers and some others. And he also screenwrote When Love is Not Enough, the Lois Wilson story. And I had him on the show several times. He was a contributor to Take 12 Recovery Radio, and we certainly will miss him. What an iconic movie, huh? My Name is Bill W.
That was a great movie. That came out right around the time that I was in treatment, believe it or not.
Oh, is that right?
You know, it was like 1989.
Yeah.
And it had a deep impact. Impact on me.
Absolutely.
You know, I met him. I did a number of different conferences where he and I both had, we played parts in the conference, and I got to know him. He's a sweet man.
Very sweet. He also did
Dog Day Afternoon.
Dog Day Afternoon.
I mean, you know, he did some serious movies.
Al Pacino, man.
Yeah. And the great story he told me was he interviewed Lois Wilson like in the 70s or mm-hmm. something, right? And he forgot all about it for many, many years. And one day he was like poking around his closet and he found all these tapes that he had taped of Lois Wilson. And that's what he based When Love is Not Enough on. You know, he dug them out. He blew the dust off of them. And, those are some serious archive material.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because it was like 100 hours worth of, you know, interviewing.
Right.
But I'd like to hear those.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful guy. He will be dearly missed.
Rest in peace.
All right. What are we doing this week, buddy?
Absolutely. All right. We're on page 51 of the book, Language of the Heart. These are great writings. Bill Wilson had the opportunity to write for the grapevine. I mean, you know, I'm sure he didn't get a lot of rejection letters from the grapevine when he put these articles in. But what I'm getting is I'm really getting a feel of how Alcoholics Anonymous evolved into what it became. And he's hashing out a lot of ideas and things maybe aren't really settled yet within the tradition or the best practice mm-hmm. of how we should operate. And we're getting a bird's eye view of his thought process and his experiences. And you know, this is really interesting. Yeah, I do a lot of workshops, so do you. And a lot of them are pretty much cover the same material. This is really an interesting workshop for me because I'm not really familiar with these writings, and they're so important if you really want to know, you know, where Alcoholics Anonymous came from, how it evolved, how it developed. So anyway, what we're going to go over today, and it's a long one, Monty, so I'm going to do a lot of reading, and there's going to be more reading and less sharing than normal, but it's Adequate Hospitalization, One Great Need, and it was written in May 1947. Now I want to tell you, in 1947, there weren't the treatment centers and the detoxes and stuff that we have today. There were some here and there. But today, you really can get hospitalization, specialized hospitalization for alcoholism, and it's not that hard to come by. Some of it's not that great, but it's not that hard to come by. So he's talking about early hospitalization in the 40s, like right after World War II. So I'm sure this is going to be really interesting, and I think we should go ahead and dig in, don't you?
Yes, let's do it.
Okay, May 1947. Despite the general effectiveness of the AA program, we often need the help of friendly agencies outside AA. Nowhere is this more strikingly true than in the field of hospitalization. Most of us feel that ready access to hospitals and other places of rest and recuperation borders on an absolute necessity. While many an alcoholic has somehow got over his bender without medical aid, and while a few of us hold the view that the hard, cold turkey method is the best, the vast majority of AAs believe that the newcomer, whose case is at all serious, has a much better chance of making the grade if well hospitalized at the outset. Indeed, we see many cases where recoveries without medical help would seem virtually impossible. Mentally, so beclouded have they become, even when temporarily sober. Now, this is really on the money. Monty, you know, just briefly, you know what I've been involved in because you've been involved in some of it with me.
Sure.
I've really paid attention to professional alcoholism treatment and recovery processes, to an extent that I probably understand it more than most people that work in treatment, and just because I've become associated with ASAM, American Society of Addiction Medicine, C4 Recovery Solutions, the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence. You know, I've revolved around all these places as well as, you know, working closely with, but not for, a lot of treatment centers that are out there, you know, helping consult or bring in, you know, meetings or whatever. So I wanted to preface this show with that. I'm not just a member in recovery that, you know, doesn't have a clue about this stuff. I've got a clue. And he's absolutely on the money. There are people who, if they don't have a medically supervised separation from alcohol, they're never going to separate from alcohol. You can put them in AA meetings until the cows come home. There needs to be a medically surveilled detoxification process and a period of time for the person brain to start working again, for them to, you know, even understand what Alcoholics Anonymous is asking them to do. So I believe that. Personally, I went to treatment, and then I went to IOP, and then I went to AA, and I drank for about 7 months. And when the time came to separate from alcohol again, for good and for all, I did not go back to treatment. I went into, you know, I cold turkeyed it, you know, on the living room floor, and I went back into Alcoholics Anonymous. And so what he's saying in this paragraph is, you know, I understand at a deep level. I'm sure you do too.
So I have a question for you here. Back then, were they dealing with more, for lack of a better term, low bottom drunks than we do today?
Yes, for the most part, yes.
Yeah.
However, by the late 40s, people were coming in who had never had the DTs, so it became more acceptable for people who hadn't gone all the way down the scale.
Yeah. Okay.
Bill described it in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions as raising their bottom. They hadn't lost everything. They hadn't been in the mental institution 13
right.
times,
right.
And we started to let them in the rooms.
Right.
So yes. And the other thing is, I remember reading Bill White's Chasing the Dragon, which is the definitive history and study on addictive illness treatment, professional treatment. And I honestly can't remember what was going on in the 40s. I know that sommeliers were doing drying out farms. They'd bring you out to their farm and make sure you didn't get drunk and expose you to AA. It was, it was very, very non-professional. But I don't know about any treatment centers today. Like the type of treatment centers we have today, I don't know of any of them that were working in the 40s. I know Elena Lodge, was started in the 50s. I know High Watch, I think that started in at least the late 40s, early 50s. And those are two of the earliest ones I know. Let's see what he's talking about when he says hospitalization. Maybe he's just talking about detox. Okay. The primary purpose of hospitalization is not to save our prospect the pain of getting sober. Its real purpose is to place him in the state of greatest possible receptivity to our AA program. Medical treatment clears his brain, takes away his jitters, and if it is done at a hospital, he is kept there under control so that everybody knows just where and when he can be visited. Moreover, the atmosphere of most hospitals is extremely conducive to a good first presentation of AA. The very fact that he has now landed in a hospital impresses the new man with the seriousness of his situation. If he has gone there voluntarily, which should be the case if at all possible, he usually regards hospitalization as the actual beginning of his sobriety. It puts, as it were, a period to his drinking. It is an admission that he needs help, that his drinking is out of control, that he cannot do the job alone. Often enough, hospitalization is the event that beautifully clears his path to acceptance of that all-important first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. So this is what I believe. Listen, Monty, a lot of treatment centers out there have an overinflated idea of how important they are. Okay. what I believe treatment is best for is for doing what he says here, clearing someone's mind, getting them ready to accept a process that's about a transformational change that's going to be a lifetime job. The crazy thing about alcoholism treatment, and this started in Minnesota. So there were some politicians, Monty, who were about to put together policy, basically parity legislation, right? They really wanted to make it incumbent upon reimbursement entities, incumbent upon them to pay the cost of alcoholism treatment because it's a disease, and we should have the same opportunities that people with cancer or heart disease. We should have the same access to professional recovery treatment. But no one really knew. None of the politicians really knew what the heck was going on. Neither really did the insurance companies. So they went to some people in Minnesota who had some experience with treatment. As you can imagine, there's some big treatment industry in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I won't mention their name, but I know you know who I'm talking about. Anyway, so they ask, they go, how long should an inpatient episode be? And the guy goes, it's kind of different for most people, but if you need a number, you know, I would say 28 days. Okay. So all of a sudden, 28 days is now the amount of time people need for professional treatment. And that's crazy because there's different experiences with alcoholism. Some people need 2 days. Some people need 2 years. You know what I mean? Like, so, but 28 days became, you know, the gold standard for, you know, reimbursement. So a lot of these treatment centers really think they're doing the serious work. What they're doing is they're readying the person for the serious work. Treatment is about discovery. You know, the 12 steps are about recovery. And that's what I believe. And you know, I don't care if you have a different opinion. You know what I mean? I have seen over and over again the revolving door of the people who think that they need treatment if they drink again. They need treatment if they drink again. They need treatment if they drink again. No, you need recovery so that you can stay sober. You know what I mean?
Yeah, amen.
Anyway, I'm going to jump off that soapbox, Bonnie. All right. With each passing year, we increasingly realize that the immense importance of adequately presenting the program to every new prospect who is in the least inclined to listen. Many of us feel this to be our greatest obligation to him and our families to do so our greatest, to not do so is our greatest dereliction. So there's, I forget exactly where this quote is, but the primary responsibility of a sponsor is an adequate presentation of the 12 steps. Mm-hmm. And the sole purpose of an AA group is the teaching and practice of the 12 steps. Those are both both of those are Bill Wilson quotes. So I'm not sure he quoted those yet. This is 1947, but he was starting to understand it and he was starting to believe it. And it's something I believe too. And a lot of times 12 step meetings have drifted way off center. They're not about the teaching and practice of the 12 steps anymore. The sponsors aren't about an adequate presentation of the 12 steps. And you see that in relapse rates. You know what I mean? But when a group really holds to its primary purpose and follows that guidance of teaching and practicing the 12 steps, that's what the group is trying to get everybody to do. And the sponsor is adequately presenting the 12 steps to the sponsee. Where you see that happening, there's really, really good recovery. You have a much better chance of surviving alcoholism if you land there. Isn't that your experience?
Absolutely it is. In fact, I'm going to quote you. And the reason I know this quote is because I've put music to it, and it's a sound clip that I use as a bumper in some of our shows. And it goes something like this. If you're going to sponsor somebody, you need to take responsibility for the people under your flag. Your job is to take them to the 12 steps, and if you're not doing that, you're a meathead and you're dangerous. Chris S.
I didn't say that, did I?
Oh, yes, you did.
Oh, man.
I love it. And I agree.
Monty, every once in a while, somebody comes up to me and says, I'm mad at you. You know, I heard something in one of your talks. You know, I'm like, what talk? You know, it's a talk you did in 1998. You know, more has been revealed.
But it's wonderful.
You know,
it's
some of the sharper edges.
Yes. And look, iron sharpens iron. The deal of it is, you know, we do need to be about the business of the business we're about. And we don't need to be about anything else.
Yeah. Shoemaker, stick to thy last.
Yeah.
It says here, Monty, the difference between a good approach and a bad one can mean life or death to those who seek our help. One of the biggest lies I ever heard when I showed up was, if they're ready, there's nothing you can do wrong. And if they're not ready, there's nothing you can do right. You know, and what that does is that absolves you of the responsibility of being a meathead.
Yeah.
Is what that does. You know what I mean? It says here, the difference between a good approach and a bad one can mean life or death to the people who seek our help. And I believe that. I believe that. We have seen excellent prospects who received nothing but our brief and casual notice continue their stumbling journey to the Undertaker, while seemingly impossible cases who had received careful and considerate attention recovered on the spot or later came back and found their sobriety. Mm-hmm. And I believe what he's talking about is, you know, the presenting the steps.
Yeah.
This careful and considerate attention can nowhere be better given than in the confines of a hospital. Remember, they used to do a lot of step work in the hospital. You know, Dr. Bob was famous for this in the Akron Hospital. If you needed, if you needed alcoholic help, he'd put you right in the hospital. And it wasn't necessarily, you know, for the nurses and doctors. What it was you were now confined. They knew where you were. You weren't going anywhere. And now they started to send in the boys, you know, to start doing the pitch.
Yeah.
Start doing the AA pitch. You know, and that's how he liked to handle it. He didn't want you out there wandering around, you know, where you could be a danger to yourself and others. He wanted you, while he's taking you through the steps, he wanted to know where you were. And, you know, that was an early, you know, experience with going through the steps. We don't necessarily do it like that anymore. But that's kind of what he's talking about here. So he says more and more AA groups are adopting the idea of sponsorship. Hey, 1947. Each newcomer is assigned a reasonably stable AA member whose ward he becomes during his brief period of introduction to our way of life. So let's read that again and break it down a little. A newcomer is assigned a reasonably stable AA. That's not really how we do it anymore.
No.
And he becomes that person's ward during the brief introduction to our way of life, the presentation of the 12 steps. The sponsor helps make hospital arrangements, takes his man there, visits him frequently, and sees that he is visited by other AAs who experience might be specifically helpful. Hence, a prospect so handled has received a powerful shot of AA and a good preview of what our society is like before he ever goes to a meeting.
Wow.
How about that, Monty?
Wow.
How about being exposed to the 12 steps before they let you come in and start disturbing a meeting?
Wow. what a concept.
Yeah, I know. At the hospital, he has time to soberly think through his situation, read our literature, and exchange impressions with other alcoholics who are going through the same process. Contrast this with the frequent attention in which, for lack of hospitalization, the sponsor has to try to taper off his prospect at home or drag him half days to an AA meeting where the new man proceeds to get a lot of confused impressions and unfounded prejudice. How about that?
Wow.
How about we should not be, the first thing we do is not take somebody to a meeting. I don't know what kind of AA you came out of, but I came out of the kind of AA where you get them and you throw them in the car and you take them to a meeting, you know?
Yeah.
And people expected the meeting to do the magic. And what Bill is saying is, no, it's not the meeting's responsibility to do the magic. It's the sponsor's responsibility to do the magic. Hmm. It's the sponsor's responsibility to introduce them to reasonably stable AAs who are going to spend a little time with them and explain what their experience with AA is. While many of us have made our first contact with AA under these unfavorable circumstances and have stuck nevertheless, there are probably many who do not stick on such poor contact. People who might have remained with us had they been properly hospitalized and sponsored.
Yeah.
Hospitalized. I love this stuff.
This
Monty.
Is great.
This is great.
And you look at this and you go, wow, here's some more reasons why the success rate was so high.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so, you know, during the writing of the big book, 50% of the people who came and really tried sobered up immediately. 25% had a couple of relapses and then sobered up, so that's a 75% recovery rate for people who came in and started to play ball with this AA thing. You know, we don't have that anymore because we've become very, very okay with people not playing ball.
Right.
Know, there's no rules, you know, come on in, you know, and for better or worse, you know, that's kind of what has happened.
Yep. Yep. It has.
So out of what is now, out of what is now a huge experience, our conclusions are these: that hospitalization is imperative in many cases. And because the hospital provides such a firm basis for good sponsorship, it is desirable, even in the less serious situations, if the prospects are drinking or foggy when contacted. They definitely have a better chance if hospitalized. And now this is all coming out of Akron. I think Bill was going to Towns Hospital. Bill was using Towns Hospital. Dr. Bob was using Akron Hospital. And they would. They'd put these people in there, and then they'd inundate them with the AAs. And by the time they got out of the hospital, they knew a dozen AAs. And they had a sponsor, and they were starting on the steps, and now we can bring them to a meeting. You know, that's really what was going on when this was written.
I love it. I love it.
Until recently, few hospitals have wanted us alcoholics. We almost never got well. We were hard to manage and disturbed other patients. We were regarded as sinners more than sick people. And as a class, we were financially irresponsible. So we caused a lot of trouble and we didn't pay our bill. You know, what's not to like?
Yeah.
The average hospital management has always said, and with good reason, why bother with drunks? We can scarcely handle the people who are legitimately sick. People we can really do something for. Sobering up drunks is a sheer waste of time and money. Happily, this attitude is changing because it is now becoming clear to physicians and the public alike that a true alcoholic is really sick, however lacking in character he may be. Hope has now taken the place of centuries of despair that anything much could be done for problem drinkers. AA and other agencies are now providing that recovery. It is possible to hundreds of thousands, and that adequate hospital care can and must play a vital part in this process. Marty Mann was pushing a lot of this stuff too. Mm-hmm. She was the first woman to stay sober in alcoholics. She started the National Council on she was a doctor, right? She started the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence. And she pushed for a lot of legislation and a lot of stigma change, you know, a lot of perceptual change to alcoholism. And I know he's thinking about that when he's writing this. Though the trend is now in the right direction, it has not yet produced any large-scale result, except the fortunate few. Most AA groups are up against it. Reasonably priced or free hospital accommodation for alcoholics is still woefully scarce. Each group has to do the best they can. And in New York and Akron, they had it made. But, you know, in Cheesequake, New Jersey, you know, what are you going to do? So that makes a lot of sense. Let's take stock, therefore, of what is generally available today and what kind of relations we can best cultivate with existing agencies. Let us also consider what part we ought to play in securing improved hospitalization. That's some serious stuff he's starting to get involved in there, Monty.
Yeah.
Many AAs have been state asylum inmates.
Yep.
While our treatment at these institutions has been far better than many suppose, it is a fact that the average asylum superintendent still prefers to handle insane persons. The average mental case stays put for a while. Then too, for mental cases, an asylum feel it was really doing something by way of either custody or cure. But the average alcoholic, unless permanently insane, was a headache. Brought in temporarily balmy, he would promptly recover his sanity, at least legally speaking, and would clamor to get out, only to return in days or weeks. No wonder the average institution disliked alcoholics. I got it now, you know. I this time it's going to be different. I got this. I don't need to be here. we just gave you $14,000 worth of free care. And now you're telling us to go pound. Boy, where can I find more people like you to treat?
You know what, Chris? And here's the thing that always amuses me, but it is sad, and it is a unfortunate reality. Today, where I volunteer, a gentleman who's only been there one day said to me, I need to leave here and get some air because I'm having problems with this other personality. And let's call the personality Joe, right? And I said, well, there's always going to be Joes no matter where you go, man, you know? And he said to me, listen, the one thing I am not going to do is I'm not going to drink. And I said, that's an interesting statement. And then we talked about how obsession doesn't conform to reason. I told him, I could hook you up to a lie detector test and you'd probably pass it. You're not going to drink. And then you'll be drunk tomorrow. How would you explain that? Well, that's not going to happen. Well, I'll tell you, I see it happen all the time because a person doesn't understand the obsession of the mind, right? So it's very interesting.
Yeah.
And you've said it before, I think it was you. Doctors are tired of us throwing up on their shoes and not paying our bills, you know. But we welcome them back anyway, you know. No boundaries.
You know, we're complaining about the food, you know. You know, our refrigerator is filled with maggots, you know, because the power went out. You know?
Oh, I know.
And we get into treatment and we complain about the food.
Oh, my gosh.
It's so typical.
It's hilarious.
So now that so many of us are coming out of asylums to stay, the authorities are everywhere becoming more cooperative. In many institutions, the alcoholics able and willing to recover are placed in the ward of their own. They are no longer mingled with the insane. Visiting AAs are admitted and meetings are held within the walls. While no asylum can, of course, be used as a simple sobering up place only, it is true that when asylum doctors are now often willing to take cases on less evidence of psychosis than formerly, provided they and the nearby AA group feel that a permanent recovery is possible. The doctors are also more willing to commit promising patients for much briefer periods and liberate earlier those who seem to be making good AA progress. So any AA group near an asylum which contains alcoholics capable of recovery can usually form these desirable relationships with the authorities, but they should never try to tell the doctors how to run the place. We must never blame any doctor who has not yet seen AA at work for his skepticism. Let us remember, he probably has good reason to be that way. He's telling us it's our responsibility to go into these institutions.
Yeah.
Do you notice that, Monty?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now you go in, you do treatment, you know, commitments. I do treatment commitments. I just kind of knew for a long time it's incumbent upon me to do that.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
And he's saying in this paragraph, get busy, you know, form these relationships with these places. Now, remember, these aren't rehabs like we have today. These are insane asylums.
Yeah.
But he's telling us to go in there, explain our recovery process, say that we can help, you know, please let us help you in here, you know, and let us help alcoholics. And there was some serious work being done back then, you know.
Yeah.
Now we have the CPC committee, you know, it goes around and hands out literature, you
right,
know what I mean?
Right.
Like back in the day, you got your hands dirty, you know, and I think we should still be doing some of this.
Yep.
Our experience with public hospitals in large cities has been varied. Here we usually find much reluctance to keep our good prospects, even a few days, unless, of course, they happen to be delirious, psychotic, or physically injured. This can happen today if you go to the ER. As soon as your blood pressure's good, they let you go, you know, if you go to an ER to be detoxed.
Yeah.
These hospitals feel they have no right to use precious beds to sober up run-of-the-mill drunks. But as public hospitals become aware that we are bringing recovery to a substantial number of their regular habituates, they become more hopeful and cooperative. Visiting privileges are extended to us, and promising cases are kept several days. The development of these relations takes place slowly. The hospital has to be thoroughly convinced that we are bringing recovery to enough patients to justify any special consideration. Because public hospitals are mostly free or very moderate in their charges, we too often abuse our privileges. We are tempted to ask special treatment for slippers who have no present idea of stopping drinking. We often insist on visiting at all hours and in any numbers. We are likely to brag about AA as the only remedy for alcoholism and thus incur the displeasure of hardworking nurses and doctors who might otherwise be glad to help us. But these natural mistakes are usually corrected And we finally come up with a friendly, clear-cut relationship, which is often handled in large AA centers through our intergroup central offices or hospital committees. So this work of being cooperative and helpful in these hospitals was obviously being done by many, many people in the 40s. I find that fascinating.
And I don't think they were just taking meetings in there and just having your standard meeting, right? They were actually working with these people. They were actually working and applying the principles of the steps with these people.
Yes, absolutely. You know, they'd start off by telling their story, and then they'd do basically what's in the chapter working with others in the book Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah.
They'd lay out the course of action for recovery, and if you said okay, you know, I want that, they'd start to work with you. If you didn't want any part of it, they'd move on and try to find somebody who might be willing or might have suffered a little bit more.
Yeah.
But that's what I believe was going on. And I wasn't there in the 40s, you know, but the literature points to a lot of that as what was going
sure.
on. We enjoy fine privileges with many private sanitariums and drying out places. Occasionally, the reverse has been true. Here and there, we have found some tendency to exploit alcoholics. Too much sedative, too many tapering off drunks, too long and too expensive stays, an inclination to misuse the AA name for business purposes, etc. But these tendencies are disappearing. It is realized, even by those who might be tempted to take liberties with us, that cooperation with AA is more profitable in the long run than non-cooperation. But it must always be remembered that on the whole, our treatment at these places is good. Some of them are staffed by the warmest friends we have. I cannot forget that the first physician ever to take a serious and helpful interest in us is still a staff member of a private hospital for alcoholics, that the first psychiatrist to see the possibilities of AA and one who had the courage to go to bat for us before his profession is a staff member of a sanitarium. When such excellent places offer us friendly cooperation, we surely ought to return it in kind. And he's talking about Silkworth. You know, some of these places have a tendency to exploit alcoholics. Monty, this is still true today. There are some treatment processes in a couple of different areas where they understand exactly how much they can scrape your insurance card clean, okay? Mm. And there are actually places that when they release you, there's a setup of people who are going to get you drunk again so that you can be admitted back into another place because there's more money left on your insurance card.
Oh, my God.
Then there's places that promise the world. They promise the world that they've got this program that, you know, no one else has and blah, blah, blah. And it's $80,000 a month. And, you know, there's horses and yoga. You know, they do yeah. goat yoga. I mean, there's just like a lot of exploiting alcoholics. You know, listen, we know what yeah. works. We're, you
yeah.
know, the information is in. we don't need somebody's brand new way of, you know, charging people enough money to buy a house, you know, for treatment. It just you just don't need to do that.
So yes. there was a student, we call them students, not clients. There was a student at the Adult and Teen Challenge Center that I was education coordinator at, and this guy had been through the revolving door. I mean, and this isn't 30, 60, 90. This is a year, and he had come several times. And his parents were livid with me because I sat him down. He was coming again. I said, you don't need this. You need to get back in the rooms. You need to get with your sponsor. You need to learn how to apply and implement those steps so you can develop a relationship with God to help you solve your problem. You know, we have taught you everything you need. You need to go do that. You don't need to be here. They were hot because they thought this will be the time, the magic time that he actually gets it, and you're preventing him from coming to treatment. Unfortunately, I don't think that's uncommon.
Oh, you know, Monty, I can't agree with you more. You know, to be able to maintain a relationship in some of these treatment centers, it's wise maybe not to do that. You know,
I know.
But you were telling him the God's honest truth.
Yeah.
You were telling him the God's honest truth. You know, you can't be faulted for that.
Right.
But I understand there's so many people that are willing to go to IOP. They're willing to sign themselves in, you know, to a residential lockdown for 28 days, mm-hmm. but they aren't willing to, you know, start going to Alcoholics Anonymous and get a sponsor and start working the steps. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I think a lot of times it just hasn't been explained to them. It just hasn't been explained to them what they really need to do.
Right.
They keep looking for outside help to help them when the help must come from inside.
Mm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Deep down within us is where we find the concept of God. So it's an inside job.
Amen.
So it says here, many sanitariums and private hospitals are necessarily too high priced for the average alcoholic. Public hospitals being too few, asylums and religious institutions too seldom available, the average group has been hard put to find spots where prospective members can be hospitalized for a few days at modest expense. They're saying for a few days, you know, get them detoxed, mm-hmm. and then start working AA with them. The urgency has tempted some AA groups to set up drying out places of their own, hiring AA managers, nurses, and securing the services of a visiting physician. Where this has been done under the direct auspices of an AA group, it has almost always backfired. It has put the group into business, a kind of business about which few AAs know anything at all. Too many clashing personalities, too many cooks spoiling the broth, usually bring about the abandonment of such attempts. We have reluctantly been obliged to see that an AA group is primarily a spiritual entity, that as a group, the less business it has to transact, the better. While on this theme, it ought to be noted that practically all group schemes to finance or guarantee hospital bills for fellow members have failed also. Not only do many such loans go unpaid, there is always the controversial question in the group as to which prospects deserve them in the first place. Hmm. This is all really, really interesting. We must cooperate and be able to get in the door of these facilities to do our AA work, but we can't be in that business. You know, we can't do it as a business, not as AA group members,
right.
is what he's saying. And he's absolutely right there. In still other instances, AA groups, driven by their acute need for medical aid, have started public money-raising campaigns to set up AA hospitals in their communities. These efforts almost always come to naught. Not only do these groups intend to go into the hospital business, they intend to finance their ventures by soliciting the public in the name of Alcoholics Anonymous. Instantly, all sorts of doubts are generated. The project bogs down. Conservative AAs realize that business ventures or solicitations carrying the AA endorsement are truly dangerous to us all. Were this practice to become general, the lid would be off. Promoters, AA and otherwise, would have a field day. So you don't see treatment centers saying they're AA treatment centers. You see treatment centers saying they're 12-step treatment centers.
Yes.
Which is a different thing, you know. This search for reasonably priced and understanding medical treatment has brought into being still another class of facilities. These are the rest farms and drying out places operated by individual AAs under suitable medical supervision. This would be like transitional living. Like there's a bunch of AAs that, you know, get a little money together and they rent or buy a house and they put a recovery residence together. You know, we're still doing that. These setups have proved far more satisfactory than group-directed projects. As might be expected, their success is in exact proportion to the managerial ability and good faith of the AA in charge. If he is able and conscientious, a very good result is possible. If neither, the place folds up. Not being a group project and not bearing the AA name, these ventures can be taken or left alone. The operation of such establishments is always best with particular difficulties, beset with particular particular difficulties. It is difficult for the AA manager to charge high enough rates to make the venture include a fair living for himself. If he does, people are apt to say that he is professionalizing or making money out of AA. Nonsense, though this may often be, it is a severe handicap nonetheless. Yet, in spite of the headaches encountered, a good number of these farms and sobering up spots are in active operation and can seemingly continue just as long as they are tactfully managed, do not carry the AA name, and do not publicly solicit funds as AA enterprises. When a place has an AA in charge, we sometimes do take thoughtless advantage of the fact. We dump alcoholics into it just to get them off our hands and promise to pay bills and do not. Any AA who can successfully manage one of these drunk emporiums ought to be congratulated. It is hard and often thankless job, though it may bring him deep spiritual satisfaction. Perhaps this is the reason so many AAs wish to try it. Hmm. I can't tell you how many people I know who are in the treatment business, friends of mine that are in the treatment business. One of the early ones, this guy's name was Charlie S., and he got a hold of this place called Honesty House. And it was one of the treatment centers that we would bring a message into. And he was an AA member, a good AA member. And he could never say no to a drunk that was asking for help. And the place went bankrupt. I mean, he could never say no, Monty.
Yeah.
You know, I can't imagine being an AA in a position to have to say no to somebody that's begging them to save their life. No, I can't take another free case. I can't take another scholarship. You know, so the place went bankrupt. But I also know people that have been incredibly successful. I've got somebody that I work very, very closely with who about 13 years ago bought one of these Victorian places, turned it into a halfway house, you know, parlayed that money into some treatment centers and into recovery residences and stuff. And ended up selling the place for 9-figure profit.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Wow.
Like in 10 years, you know, yeah. 9-figure profit. So, and now it's part of, you know, a venture capitalist, you know, endeavor or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably not going to remain as good as but when he was in charge of it, man, people were recovering. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the insurance companies were coming to him and saying, "Whatever the hell you're doing, can we pay you more money?"
Oh, wow!
It was that apparent that he was doing such a good job that there was no, the recidivism that they follow those statistics, and the incarceration, they follow those statistics, and, you know, the emergency room visits, they follow those statistics. These people were recovering and they weren't costing the insurance companies any more money. So they're like, whatever you're doing, let us help you.
Wow.
You know, wow. So that's unusual.
Yeah, very.
I mean, but it was because he was an AA. The question often arises about what to do in a severe case when no hospital is available. First of all, we ought, if possible, to call a doctor. We should ascertain for the doctor's benefit how long our man has been drinking and particularly whether he has been taking much sedative. Under no circumstances should we laymen ever administer any sedatives. That's funny because in the big book, it tells us we may have to administer
sedatives. Yeah.
In the chapter working with him. He's now saying he probably learned that we're not great sedative administrators, Amani. How did you do with sedative administration work? You were probably as bad at it as I was.
Yeah, see, if I was to do that, I may end up taking the sedatives. I don't know.
We must leave this strictly to the doctor. So medical surveillance, medical supervision,
yeah.
Okay? We favor hospitalization from the befogged. We favor a medical profession when the person is coming out of a drunk because you can die. You can die from alcohol withdrawal.
Yep.
So you got to kind of know what you're doing. And you got to be able to prescribe. I mean, you know, you have to at least be a nurse practitioner, you know, to be able to prescribe these days.
Yeah.
So in some places, AAs take turns sitting the clock around, tapering off a man with a bad hangover. Though this can sometimes be done the patient will usually insist on tapering himself up instead of off. Now and then, we have to adopt the desperate expedient of putting a man in jail, especially if violent. But when absolutely necessary, patients, persuasion, and a doctor's help will generally do the trick, if the patient will really try. If he won't, there's little to do but let him drink on until he's had enough.
Yeah.
You know, that's absolutely true. How do you stop somebody from drinking who wants to continue to drink?
You don't.
Among AAs, one hears much discussion about the merits of the of several treatments. Actually, our only concern about physical treatment is that of being satisfied that the physician in charge understands alcoholics. Two other promising prospects for good and reasonably priced hospitalization are in view. These are the various general hospitals which continue to open their doors to us. Very early in AA history, Catholic hospitals in a few Midwestern cities saw our need and took us in, regardless of denomination. Their example has led other religiously oriented institutions to do likewise, for which we are extremely grateful. Quite recently, other private and semi-private general hospitals have begun to show great interest. Sometimes they go so far as setting apart wards for AA use, admitting alcoholics in our on our recommendation only, giving us generous visiting privileges and very reasonable rates. Arrangements of this sort already functioning have been so satisfactory to both hospitals and AA that many such setups should soon be active. In these situations, we do not participate in hospital management. We are afforded special privileges in exchange for our cooperation. That's like the birth of these religiously oriented hospitals. Catholic Charities, nobody ever talks about them, Monty, but they do such good work, mm-hmm. and they're everywhere. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah.
But they're not the only denomination that does good work. You know, there's also an Episcopal system of care, and a lot of times, you know, religious leaders or priests or whatever, or bishops or whatever, are in charge of these places. And you know, listen, when you need a place, this is the 40s. Remember, when you need a place, you gotta find it. And I think the religious institutions understand a little bit about what alcoholism is. Alcoholism is a toxic experience of self-consciousness. So that's what our problem is. And the solution to that is an experience with God consciousness. That's the solution.
Right.
So a lot of these religious organizations kind of understand that intuitively and are continuing to be helpful. But you know, just one, you know, Catholic Charities is a place that should be looked into if you're looking for some kind of help.
Chris, isn't there a relationship here in the history of this thing between the Salvation Army and Alcoholics Anonymous? Wasn't there some history there?
You know, between those two, I will tell you that the Salvation Army has had its own program of recovery for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And they're more of a longer term experience, but it's the same thing. It's getting you in touch with God. They're just doing it in a different way.
Yeah.
They're doing it in a more religious way. But a lot of the Salvation Armies, you know, let AAs come in to give the AA message. Sure.
Yeah, you bet.
You know, we're all trying to cooperate. You know, we're all mission driven. If you're Salvation Army, you're mission driven. If you're AA, you're mission driven. So, you know, we can get together and we can collaborate. Yep. It surely may be said that the future looks bright. Much more hospitalization based on the certainty that we are sick people and that plenty can be done about it is now on the way. We ought to gratefully acknowledge the work of those agencies outside AA who are strenuously helping this life-saving trend along. State, county, and municipal governments, large universities are agitating our cause. They are being ably seconded by various hospital and other associations. While traditionally AA does not ever exert any political or promotional pressure, we can as individuals make our great need for sufficient hospitalization known to all who might be interested, emphasizing, of course, that though we believe hospitalization to be primarily a medical problem for communities and physicians to answer, we AAs would like to cooperate in every possible way.
Yeah.
And it's that attitude of cooperation that's kept us in many institutions. And where we didn't cooperate or where our message was contrary to, you know, the treatment protocols, you know, we've been exited. There's plenty of treatment centers out there that don't want the AAs coming in, you know.
Right.
And
right.
That's unfortunate. That's been mishandled one way or the other by either one side or the other. It's been mishandled because we can collaborate and cooperate for a good experience.
This article really opened my eyes. I mean, I had no idea. I mean, I knew that there was a relationship between AA treatment and hospitalization, but I had no idea the way we approached it back then. This is excellent. Excellent. Nice job, brother.
This is another one where I'm learning as much as anybody that listens to this is learning. I'm learning too. So it's a great experience.
Next week, what do we got next week?
Lack of money. Monty, we all understand that, don't we? Lack of money proved in AA boom. So going broke was the best thing that could happen. and you know, sometimes that's true.
Yeah.
You know
sometimes,
I mean?
Sometimes it is. Well, Chris, thank you so much for another excellent episode of Walking Through the Language of the Heart. I want to tell listeners, and I do this, I try to do this at the end of every one of these episodes. Really, if you want some filet mignon with Chris and myself, really getting into the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, visit us at take12radio.com. Click on the Recovery Workshops banner, and there you'll find Walking Through the Big Book and Walking Through the 12 and 12. Very similar to what we're doing here. And I got to tell you, we've had an amazing response on all those previous workshops, and it's because of you, our listeners, and passing it on. And you can download all that stuff for free. Doesn't cost you a penny. Just download it, share it, burn copies of it as well. All right. Well, we will see you again next week, my friend. We've got a long way to go through this book, but we're going to make it. I have faith that we're going to make it. All right. Until our next broadcast. This is the Monty Man, along with Chris S., wishing God's serenity for you. Bye-bye. For more recovery workshops with Chris S. and the Monty Man, visit our website at take12radio.com and click on the Recovery Workshops banner.
This has been a broadcast of Take 12 Recovery Radio and KHLT Recovery Broadcasting.
Kitty, 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 kitty. Meow, meow, meow.
Woof, woof.